This is the Edgewalker teleconference on February 17th, 2015, and our special guest on this call is Greg Lavoie, whom I'll introduce in a minute. But I want to welcome the participants that are on, and we know that a couple of others may join us after the call gets started. But why don't you say hello, say your name and where you are, and then we'll move into a little bit of contemplative time before we start the introductions with Greg. So please say your name and where you're located.
I'm Denise Campbell, and I'm located in Chicago, Illinois.
Thank you, Denise.
This is Liz Denta. I'm in East Tennessee.
Hi, Liz.
Hey, Judy. Hi, Greg. Last
Hello there.
Saw you at one of the spirituality and business conferences in Mexico when your first book, or at least my first book of yours, came out.
All right.
Yeah, I've recommended it many, many times.
Judy and I were discussing, where was that in your recollection in Mexico?
Well, they were in Mazatlan and Puerto Vallarta and Acapulco, and I can't remember which one it was.
Okay.
We're all on the same planet of not remembering that one. But we know we were together. That was the important thing.
Right.
Absolutely.
All right. Who else would like to check in?
This is Sam Simon. I'm in McLean, Virginia, suburban Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Sam. Hi.
Hi, Prusha Bissell from Upper Freehold, New Jersey.
Hi, Prusha. Welcome, and I owe you a phone call.
Great. Thank you.
I haven't forgotten. I've just been kind of overwhelmed, and I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Hi, everybody. This is Simone Feaster-Armor, and I'm in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Can you say your name again, please? It got
Simone
muffled.
Feaster-Armor.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. This is Benita Esposito, and I'm from the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Georgia.
And you have also attended a lot of spirit and business type conferences.
Mm-hmm. Enjoyed it immensely. And Greg, I've known of your work for many years and have told many of my clients about it.
Marvelous. Thank you. I also live just up the road from you in Asheville.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, it's such a small, beautiful world. Wonderful. All right. Is that everybody so far? Are we missing anybody?
This is Ellis Ralph from Northwest Arkansas.
Oh, of course. Can't miss you. That's my husband, everybody. calling from upstairs in Northwest Arkansas. Thank you, Ellis. All right, why don't we go ahead and begin then, and knowing that we may hear some bells as other folks join us, and so we'll welcome them in spirit, and they can then join the conversation after Greg and I do a little bit of discussion with each other. So I want to open with a quote from Greg's newest book, which is titled Vital Signs, The Nature and Nurture of Passion. Greg writes, "What would it mean to put everything on the line for our beliefs? What would happen if we got off the merry-go-round altogether, left it all behind, risked everything? What does giving it all up to God really mean? What would it be like to set our lives on a completely new course, guided by entirely different values and reference points, to make one of those radical changes that completely redefine who we are and how we go about life?" Please join me in a moment of silence while we hold these questions.
Julie Minkle.
Hi, Julie. Welcome to the call, and we invite you to join us in just a moment of silence.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, everyone. It's my great pleasure to introduce Greg Lavoie, who is the author of Vital Signs, The Nature and Nurture of Passion, and his first book, Callings, Finding and Following an Authentic Life, which was rated among the top 20 career publications by the Workforce Information Group. And it's been a text in various graduate programs in management and organizational leadership. If you're curious about that, you can go to Greg's website, where there's actually a list of the different programs that Callings has been used in as a textbook. Greg is a lecturer and a seminar leader in business and educational venues and government, faith-based, and human potential arenas. He's a former adjunct professor of journalism at the University of New Mexico and a former columnist and reporter for USA Today and the Cincinnati Inquirer, also author of a book called This Business Writing. And he's written for the New York Times Magazine, Washington Post, Omni, Psychology Today, Christian Science Monitor, Reader's Digest, and many, many others, which he writes about his whole career in writing in this book and how that unfolded. And he also writes for corporate promotional and television projects. So, Greg, as we mentioned before the recording started, you and I met in Mexico at the Spirit and Business Conference. We're not sure which city it was in, but we do remember that wonderful time of the conference and the chance to meet and a delightful lunch together talking about what we're passionate about. Mm-hmm. And so you are now passionate about passion, and I'm just so delighted that we're going to talk about that today. So welcome.
Well, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So I'm going to ask you a few questions. We'll talk for about 20 or 25 minutes. And then we'll open up the call for others to also ask questions or comment. And you may have questions for people as well. So this is an opportunity to dialogue.
Wonderful.
So I wanted to start by talking about, you know, when I work with people in the edgewalker work that I do, I find over and over that one of the main gaps for people is the sense that they feel like they're supposed to do something with their lives, but they can't figure out what it is. It's their purpose and passion. And you talked a lot about this kind of longing in your first book, Callings. So in your new book, Vital Signs, how do you build on that in helping people to clarify and nurture this sense of passion? And you know, what brought you from writing Callings to writing Vital Signs?
Yeah. They were separated, just for the record, by a five-year moratorium on writing. So I didn't actually go from one directly into the other. I hit a phase of something I've never hit in my work life before, which was burnout. And I think it was partly a function of how I went about writing Callings, which was 2 years alone in a room, which is good for getting things done, not great for work-life balance. So I had a five-year hiatus, but when I came back, I started writing a series of essays. I just said, I'm not writing a book, not interested in a book, just going to sit down and write exactly and only what I am most fascinated about. And I started for several years. I wrote nothing but essays. I refused to call them chapters. And then I looked back and looked for some of the threads, and one of the threads that kept coming through was the subject of passion. And the difference, I think, between Callings and the new book is that I think, in a sense, Callings is about finding a passion. And I think the new book is more about living passionately. So it takes the subject and just broadens it into all different arenas, not just vocation, but relationship and creativity and spiritual life and other arenas. So it's really just looking at what I think of now as the skill of passion. It's really a stance or a mindset, I think, not so much a place we get to, but a place we come from.
Yeah, in fact, those are the words that you describe in the beginning, is it's a place we come from.
Right.
And in Edgewalkers, I talk about passion as being one of the five essential qualities of being that are needed for people to live on their emerging edge. And yeah, and
do you mind me asking what the other four are?
Yeah, no, don't mind at all. But the first one is self-awareness. That's the bedrock that everything else is built on. You can't be passionate about something if you don't know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And then passion is is getting a clearer and clearer sense of what your purpose is, why you're here on the planet in this lifetime, what is your calling? You know, it's all tied in. And then the third one is integrity, and by integrity I mean living in alignment with your deepest values, to be integral, to be whole. Mm-hmm. The fourth one is vision, and I mean vision in the sense of having visions, of being able to envision and create what's never been created before. And the fifth one is playfulness, which is using one's whole brain, one's whole self, to being able to be spontaneous. And all of these came from my research, so the research base. And when you said, about playfulness, you know, that was my feeling when that emerged, that was like, wow, that was not expected. And yet I saw it over and over again in people who have a deep spiritual life and who walk between the material world and the spiritual world and very effective in business, is this sense of playfulness. And even spiritual leaders, the ones that I would follow, have that sense of spirit of playfulness and joy.
That really rings a bell for me, because I think one of the critical faculties, essential active ingredients in a passionate life, is wonder and awe, which I think of as, in a sense, belonging especially to childhood, where we really have that beginner's mind on active duty. And I think that playfulness piece is critical. I remember Carl Sagan writing about the difference between going into a kindergarten class and a high school class to talk about science. And he describes the kindergartners as just open for business, you know, just endlessly enthusiastic and natural-born scientists, never heard of a stupid question. And he describes the high schoolers as jaded, and in particular, missing the element of wonder and awe, which they relegate at that point to just kid stuff. And I just think the loss of that capacity is not a good thing.
Well, and in fact, that's what you write about in your first chapter entitled Eyes Wide Open, that wonder and awe. And the first half of that chapter is fairly depressing, actually, as you read through and see what the educational system has done for people. I mean, we talk about it at dinner parties all the time. You know, everyone's down on the educational system. But what are you recommending change about that? Or do you have examples of educational systems that really do create a place for that wonder and awe?
Well, I mean, the first thing that pops into my mind is some of the systems like Montessori. Where what they're allowing kids to do, and this is definitely not every parent's or teacher's cup of tea, but what they're allowing them to do for years and years is play, is do whatever they want to do, and the program is built around what they want to explore, what they're fascinated by, and as young kids, what kids love more than anything is typically play, and reading, writing, and arithmetic tend to sit up on a shelf collecting dust. But I think these are brilliant, and there was a whole story in the book about one of these kinds of schools and what happens when those kids get into a public school, and they all eventually go to high school there. And it's just fascinating to watch these what happens in these settings. But I think your first, what do you call these five elements? You have a overarching umbrella term.
I call them qualities of being.
Qualities of being. Well, I think the first quality of being, the one you mentioned, self-awareness, is something that really could be bundled in better to the educational system starting from day one. Encouraging kids to really listen into themselves and develop this internal core of authority, not just listening to the authority that comes from outside of them. Now, that, of course, requires to some degree that parents teach children to listen to their own voices, not just mommy and daddy's, and same thing with teachers, but also to teach some of the contemplative arts as well as, the digital arts. You know, this week's Time magazine has a story in it about mindfulness practice and meditation being brought into schools, and they had cited about a half a dozen studies showing that it improves everything from their test scores to their social skills. And I think that's getting there. You know
yeah,
what I'm saying?
Definitely a huge start. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. But just to teach them to really journal, to talk to themselves, to talk to one another in small groups, to pay attention, develop their emotions and their senses as much as their thinking and analyzing. And
I would add, art is an important part of that. Julie Minkle, who's on this call, is an art therapist, so I bet she's grinning from ear to ear that I'm saying this. But art is such a beautiful way to begin to express who you are and to tap inside and you know, learn more about yourself and your relationship to others and to the outside world. And that usually is the first thing to go.
Unfortunately, yes. In the budget cuts, it tends to be one of the first things to go, and I think that's not a good thing either.
No.
But, you know, and also just things that have been batted around, of course, in this debate for some time now, like approaching students as if they were eager to learn, not like you have to force their mouths open and stuff the data in, but as if they're natural born learners. And I just think that's important as well.
Absolutely. Well, you're reminding me of, you know, because I'm a product of that kind of system that is a memorize and regurgitate system and please the teacher. And you know, I came out top of my class in college because I got really good at memorizing and regurgitating, although it was only short term. I could never remember it long term. And then when I went to graduate school, they wanted me to think for myself, and I had no clue how to do that. It was very disturbing. It was shocking, but a worthwhile transformation to go through. Wouldn't it be wonderful if people could get that early on instead of having to wait until they're in their 30s?
Yeah. You know, one of the factors that might figure in here is that, I mean, I've seen this over and over in anybody in a position of leadership or stewardship, which really encompasses parents, teachers, mentors, ministers, coaches, counselors, CEOs, you name it, that our passion is critical to their engagement. In other words, the people who come to us for study and for learning, for our students, our congregants, our whatever, our employees, is our passion as teachers, as mentors, as managers, is critical to the engagement of the people we work for and on whose behalf we work. And this is probably explains why when I headed off to college, my dad's advice was, don't take courses, take professors.
Great advice, because they're the ones who are passionate.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's where you'll learn. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd like to quote something again that you've written and ask you to talk about that a little bit. You write, to express, because we're talking about like artistic expression and journalistic expression and many, many forms of expression, to express means to push outward, to press into being, and not just to transmit, but to reveal, the way tears reveal grief and dreams confess desires. The way you squeeze juice from an orange or press clay into shape. And I just have to say, Greg, I love the way you write. That's so beautiful. The way you squeeze juice from an orange or press clay into shape. It's giving birth to your passions, visions, and talents, as well as to yourself. Unearthing and sharing your deepest authenticity, if not the deeper voices that want to speak through you, which are also trying to push their way into the world. Your Buddha nature, your Christ consciousness, your true self. That's so spiritual, that quote, and really moved me as I read it. And I'd like to ask you, what factors or behaviors or what is it that someone can do to break through the inhibitions that you talk about in this book? You list the ways we're inhibited by society and by ourselves so much, but we want to break through that to live a passionate life.
Right.
How does that happen? What's that process?
Oh, boy. I don't know if there's one chronology I can point to, but I can point to several factors. I think one of them is the willingness to look at where you lose your vitality, where you're so inhibited that you're blocked. And I think the in order to live a passionate life, you have to confront whatever is blocking its expression. And I think some of the work, the good, hard human work of all of this is to really look at where passion and vitality and life force and spark, and call it what you will, leak out of our lives. Whether it's a job that sucks the life out of you, or a relationship where you're pretty much a ghost of your full glorious self, or your eager, capable mind being put in some boring circumstance, you know, just to begin to identify where vitality drains out, I think is some of the work. I also think the willingness to step from the sidelines onto the playing field is a critical piece. This is not new. It's about risk-taking. But I don't think that people should start with the big risks at all. They should start with the little manageable ones that are right in their own backyard, and taking your jokes to open mic night. Being the first to make up after a quarrel. When somebody asks you how you're doing, tell them how you're really doing. You know, just lots of the little ways you can just practice acting on your fascinations, your curiosities, your passions, your exuberance, your desire to express yourself and get what's on the inside out. So I think that risk-taking and novelty, find little ways of bundling novelty into your days, because I think of it as a corrective to habit and routine and just everyday kinds of trances. There are some days when I make this a little mission for myself is find 10 ways to bring some novelty into my life. And I get up on the other side of the bed. I sit at a different side of the table, the breakfast table, because mm-hmm. the view is entirely different from one quarter turn, you know, drive to work a slightly different route, buy something you've never bought before at the grocery store, rearrange one piece of furniture in your house, you know, that kind of stuff. But all of these are little ways of just pushing out past the comfort zone and into some new territory, which is just naturally enlivening.
So you're reminding me of a book that I recommend to clients all the time. It's called, I had a therapist who recommended this book to me when I was really, really stuck in a relationship that was unhealthy. And the title of the book is One Small Step Can Change Your Life. And it talks about how our brain is wired for habit, and particularly the amygdala, the lizard brain, wants stability. It does not like change. And so you have to trick the amygdala by doing these little novelties that you're describing. It's like it goes, oh, that's so silly. That's not really a change. And so it doesn't freeze up and try to block the change. And so you take these small steps, and suddenly your life is different. And when
I'm sorry, that's a wonderful example. The brain is also wired, I think, to notice anything moving against a still background. I mean, just the ocular system is wired that way. It's a survival mechanism, really. And I think it works maybe as a good metaphor for novelty, is find ways of creating movement against the still background of status quo, day to day, same old, same old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we're going to, in just a couple of minutes, we're going to move the status quo from our just the two of us talking. So I'd like to ask you one more question. Actually, it's a pair of questions. Before we open it up to everyone else, because I'm sure they're eager to join in the conversation. And I'll put them together. What is the role of shadow work in nurturing one's passion, and what is the role of spirituality?
Shadow. Oh, boy.
Well, you talked a little bit about that when you were talking about where are the leaks. That might be a part of that.
Right, and I guess in this notion about in order to live with vitality. You have to be willing to look at whatever is in its way, whatever insecurities or fears or obstacles. And, you know, most therapeutic, psychotherapeutic systems are based on this, that if you would be healed in whatever way you want to be healed in your life, you it's kind of a three-step strategy. One of them is you confront pain or sufferings, obstacles, process it, and begin to reclaim your vitality. So I think, I mean, in the sense of shadow, being willing to look at some of the things we don't want to look at, I think is part of coming back to life. In fact, I am actually a really big believer in a mortality meditation. Talk about the great big shadow, you know, the ultimate boogeyman is, and I don't think it's morbid, I think it's life-giving to recognize and remember always that we have a use-by date, you know, and to use that, something that is definitely in the shadow realms for most people is the physical fact of their personal death, as a gentle reminder, a gentle and firm reminder that, you know, that we have an expiration date and this is our precious nick of time, and to sink our teeth into it while we can. And I think one other piece before we shift gears is one of the most brilliant things anybody ever said to me was, you should learn how to suffer creatively, not just neurotically.
Wow.
I think it's brilliant because, you know, suffering, in other words, that is useful. Suffering that leads to insights and solutions and change. And, you know, we were talking about education before. Educate means to draw out. I'm just saying make it literal by drawing it out, your obstacles, writing about your obstacles, your shadow, talking about it, playing it up.
Mm-hmm. Or creating poetry or music or art or some
exactly.
other expression, because we're talking about the role of expression.
Right.
Yeah. Wow, beautiful.
One last piece. In terms of shadow, I'm very clear that passion is not just about exuberance and joy and kicking up your heels. It's also sorrow and grief and anger and righteous anger. These are all forms of passion and energy. And I think of an interview I saw with Larry King, and he was the interviewee, and somebody asked him, who makes a great guest for your show? And he said, well, you've got to be funny, you've got to be articulate, you've got to be self-deprecating, and you've got to have a chip on your shoulder.
Oh,
and I
wow.
love that. I'm not necessarily encouraging people to nurture their grudges, but I like the idea of acknowledging that they are a force of nature, you know, mm-hmm. and this is part of what's in the shadow for a lot of people is where are your grudges? Where do you have a chip on your shoulder?
Yeah, or what are you angry about in the world that you want to do something about? Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there's something else you write about in terms of passion, not just being exuberance. You write about it as being perseverance.
Which
looks different from the sense of our typical kind of stereotype of a passionate person.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think that passion is sometimes patience on the order of years. I think of Malcolm Gladwell's comment about the 10,000 hours. Remember that?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Mastery in any profession requires a minimum of 10,000 hours of dedicated practice. And the math on that is 90 minutes a day for 20 years. You know, so this notion of passion is like a, you know, it's just some inherently unstable element, and it's going to, you know, you look at the periodic table, and where you see passion, it's like prone to degrading quickly in the presence of commitment. You know, it isn't necessarily the case. You know, I mean, I think of one of my heroes is Scheherazade. She's the queen whose stories make up all the Arabian Nights. Took her 1,001 nights. That's 3 years to turn the salt around. That's passion as patience.
Yeah,
and
perseverance, and Gladwell also was saying that you don't need talent; you need the perseverance.
I know
that the 10,000 hours is where the talent comes from. It doesn't just start out that way. You might have a propensity or a gift, but it's the 10,000 hours that makes that manifest
sure.
in the world.
Anybody yeah. who's ever acted in a play or played in a band knows this one already intuitively, that the amount of time they spend rehearsing compared to performing is like 90-10.
Yeah.
You know, but it's, yeah. you know, huh? it's passion, I think, that explains people's willingness to put up with that kind of an equation where you practice the same lyrics or the same lines for thousands of hours for the chance to perform it, what, a tenth of the time maybe?
Right, right. Yeah. Oh, juicy stuff. Wonderful. Thank you. So let's open the conversation up to anyone else who would like to ask a question. So I'll suggest is that you say your name first so Greg knows who he's talking to, and the lines are all open.
So this is Sam, if I could jump in.
Yes, Sam.
In part because I am now an actor, so we could talk about those last comments for quite a while. Because I do a solo show, and I do it over and over and over and over again, and yet every time I do it, I find new meaning in it, and I wrote it, so how about them apples? But my question is this, because one of the insights that I've, at least I think it's an insight, begun to develop is how my own vision and view of the world has changed over my time in life. And I'm engaged in something now that I find, that I discovered and has radically changed me and my life, and it is like a calling. But I look back and don't know that I could be where I am and be who I am without having gone through some of these insights and experiences which were very fundamental to me. And so I occasionally I don't know quite the word, but get concerned about the very, very enthusiastic, very young people who haven't had quite the experiential path that people have gone, spent more time. I don't know if I'm being clear about that, but the life experiences have been, seem to have been all pointing to who I am now. And so maybe, so I'm curious as to your view about the role of history and time in your life so that you better understand and see and can calibrate where you are today.
Whoa, that's a wonderful and wonderfully complex question. Let me see. Let me shoot from the hip. I don't know if this is quite addressing what you're asking, but I have kept journals since high school, and I have an entire shelf filled with personal journals that go back at this point now 45 years, and I've read through them four times at four different transitions and during book writing projects. I've read through them, and I remember Isabel Allende, the author who wrote House of the Spirits, referring to these as the journals that bear witness to life. And when I read back over those, I get a big dose of my own history. And one of the things that never fails to strike me about that is how incredibly rich life is and how easy it is to let thousands of marvelous details slip through the cracks when we don't write them down or in some way capture them. And I realized that I didn't remember half of these events, more than half, probably closer to 7/8 of them, unless I had those journals. And it's easy to forget how rich life is. And we were talking about education before, and I was thinking, I think I mentioned journaling as one of the things that I think it would be a wonderful practice to do, just to remember your own history and remember how rich your life has been and remember how many incredible details there have been, and that alone is a huge part of the richness of life, is just to remember all these fabulous details and not just follow the career track or the professional arc of your life I don't know if this is responding to your question, but that's what struck me. I've struck
Sam,
you.
Sam, you want to respond?
The reaction to that is part of what strikes me is that I've had fairly, you know, a series of moments and experiences that I could not assess until now, so much later in my life. And so I even now have some humility about my own perceptions of things, although I've discovered something. I've become an actor around a play I wrote that seems to have been, you know, have found the passion. But I don't know that I could have done this but for everything else that has happened. And I don't know if journaling would have helped or not. It's just about, to me, understanding that there are, let me put it this way. I'm also a fan of Joel Jaworski and his view of sort of looking back over your shoulder to see what your life path has been in order to see your path forward. In some ways, I feel I'm doing a variation on that theme of realizing that all those things that happened in my life happened in order that I might be here now for this activity and this purpose. But I don't know that, you know, it doesn't feel like I could have influenced it before. So it's important to be open to something like this happening. And by the way, I love your idea of passion for supervisors and whatever you do, doing it with passions and its impact on those who see you and work with you and become alive. That's an aside, but I sort of wish I had more of those people in my life. Maybe I would have been here sooner. I'm in a point of, to quote somebody else, radical amazement about where I found myself and the fact that I don't know if I could have been here earlier.
Right. Yeah, that everything led up to where you are now. Right.
Yeah. Thank you, Sam. Someone else have a question or a comment for Greg?
This is Denise Campbell, and I have probably more of a comment. When you talked about living passionately, the skill of passion, and not be at a place that you get to, but a place that you come from, I've spent like the last year, almost not quite a year, maybe not till last April, being introduced to the faith at work world that I knew nothing about. It was foreign to me. And the way by which it came to me, I left that meeting thinking, oh, my God, I have no clue what they're talking about. But this person said to me, the answers are in you. I'm thinking, what are you talking about? I felt like I had gone through a period of time where my life was shut down, but this last year has been a search for that new. And I hit a place once I got past the unknown to it opens a door. I feel like it became a domino effect that opened doors and these begin to open. It became that wonder and awe, and I felt like that kindergartner and that something was new, and I was relentless in my pursuit, and I couldn't drink enough. I couldn't search enough, and I just was like in awe and wonder. And I'm still like that, and I feel like how could this have existed, and this is who I am from inside. But it took me all that the previous person was talking about to get, but literally my previous experience almost had to be shut down for me to now live from the inside out and flow into this new awe and wonder that has me like sound like a crazy person right about now because I get excited by talking about it. But all that you're talking about is like where I am right now, 10 months into it. And now I'm like, I want to run and I want people to know about it. And I want to be that, but it's all about the awe and wonder. But now I feel like I wasn't getting to a place. It was always inside. It's what he told me. It's inside of you, but I couldn't see it then. I had to go on an adventure of search and to get to the wonder and awe. And, you know, the next phase will be taking that and maintaining that to do and accomplish the work that which I've been called.
Marvelous. Thank you for sharing that. I'm struck by your kind of almost a side comment that you're coming across as a crazy person. And I think that's an interesting commentary because, you know, what you sound like to me is an enthusiastic person. And I think that we have somewhere in the back of our minds that our natural born exuberance is somehow a little off kilter, you know, and that we're afraid that people are going to judge us for being crazy if we're enthusiastic. And this is, of course, a spectrum. I mean, it goes from just boredom all the way to evangelical fervor and, you know, and beyond. But enthusiasm and life force, which sounds like you're full of at the moment, doesn't sound crazy to me. People who are not in touch with it seem crazy to me. Besides, you have a wonderful word.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that because sometimes I, you know, not that I was even using crazy in the negative, but it's just like a crazy faith and a crazy love for where I'm at. That's what I was trying to explain. It's just such a continual everyday, you know, my journey, where are we going today with this? You know, what else can I drink in that I'll be able to share? And it's not anything I turn off. I go to bed and I get up. I go to bed with it. I wake up and it's still there. And it's just been on this. And when you hit wonder and awe, that's where I'm at. That's just where I'm at.
Wow. You know, Judy, you were mentioning, you had asked the question, which I don't think we ever got to, what role spirituality plays in the unfolding of passion. Well, listening to her talk, I'm reminded that the origin of the word enthusiasm means the God within. En-theos means the God within. So that by following your deepest enthusiasms, you are literally following, articulating, honoring, expressing God, or whatever your version of that would be. But I think that's interesting right there.
Wow. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is Judy. And my interpretation of the, you know, the definition that I was given for enthusiastic is to be filled with God.
Right.
So the same idea of God within. And and you don't know Denise, but Denise is clearly living a ministry. And this is a very spiritual calling for her. So you just really hit the nail on the head. That's so perfect.
Huh.
Right, Denise?
Absolutely. I'm so glad I'm on this call. I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this tonight.
It's a real affirmation of who you are and the journey you're on.
That's
beautiful.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Someone else have a comment or a question?
This is Prusha. This is a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much. And something that both Denise and Sam raised about looking back to see forward and discovering the answers within. Self-awareness is so difficult. I think there's a Nietzsche quote that says, one's own self is very well hidden from one's own self, and of all the treasures you find, your own is the last thing that you dig up. I wondered if Greg or Judy or both of you would be willing to describe an experience where you came to realization of self-awareness of who you are and what your passion actually is.
Greg?
Judy, you have something in mind?
Are you talking to Judy, Greg, or are you talking to Prusha?
Oh, no, I was asking you, Judy, if something popped into your mind that you wanted to share.
The story is too long for the call, so I defer to you. You're our guest, and I'd love to hear from
you. Let's see. So a time in my life when I had an opening about who I really was. Did I get that right?
Right. That's it.
Oh, boy.
Very hard.
Well, let me see. here's one example that pops into my mind. I was a reporter for about 10 years for the Gannett Company, and this was the Cincinnati Inquirer and USA Today. And I think after about 3 years out of the decade that I was working for those papers, I realized I didn't really fit here, and that what I needed to be doing was being a freelance writer, writing my own stories rather than stories that were assigned to me. And I wanted to write more national stories than regional stories, because I spent most of my time in Cincinnati. And what I did with that is classic hero's journey stuff. Phase one of responding to a calling is typically avoiding it. And I spent half a decade putting my head in the sand, as it were, and ignoring who I really was and what I really needed to be doing. And it took the loss of the job at USA Today to shock me into remembering who I really was and what I really needed to do. And I think that being at USA Today at all was an elaborate form of avoidance that just simply caught up with me. I'd been taken from the Enquirer and moved to D.C. to be a journalist there for USA Today, and I jumped at it because I had been wanting to get out of Cincinnati for years, and I thought this was my ticket out, and it turned out not to be my ticket out. My ticket out was that I had to create my own life as a freelancer, and it was only with loss that I was pushed into gain. You know, and this is one of the reasons why I'm a very big believer in not lamenting loss all that much, but using it, plowing it in, suffering creatively again, and using it as a way to come back to myself. And in this case, that was a painful way to go, but I think it works that way for a lot of people, that what finally gets them to change is their own suffering. It's like Sanford and Son. Who's the actor who was the father on that show? Oh, I can't remember his name. He said, heroes are not born. They're cornered.
Red Fox.
That's it. Thank you. Is that Denise?
Yes, that's Denise.
Yeah, Red Fox. He said, heroes are not born. They're cornered, which I think is a brilliant insight, how we are forced into awakening by our own suffering. So this is one of the reasons I think that there's a lot to be said for suffering. And that was the event that finally got me to wake up, and at that point I became very practical about making my life come true, literally. And that is that I set myself a deadline of 1 year, every Thursday night for 3 hours, I was going to become a student of the life I wanted to live. And it took about a year and three quarters, but it's what set me up to finally leave employment for self-employment.
Yeah. Great question and great story. And this is Judy, and I was reflecting on a couple of phrases you used about coming back to yourself because of the suffering and the loss. And as I think of a transformation point in my journey, it was a federal lawsuit. I was a whistleblower at a defense plant. And that transformational journey was not coming back to myself at all. It was discovering a self I didn't know that existed that was courageous. I didn't know I was courageous. I didn't know I had a backbone. And by taking this action was to come to discover a strength that I never had had in my life that became new, that now sometimes has a shadow side.
It's
like, don't mess with me, you know, when there's times I could be more compassionate. But that was really a coming to myself that probably was in there somewhere, but I sure don't have any of that in my history anywhere until that confrontation with a major corporation and then a federal courthouse. And I won the lawsuit, by the way.
All right.
Use the money to set up the Center for Spirit at Work. So.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Okay, we have time for one more question or comment.
Well, this is Ellis, and I'd like to comment on the concept of the mortality meditation. I was really struck by that, and I've thought that I am very grateful for my mortality, because I realized that if things were set up so that we were immortal, then I would be insufferable. I would not appreciate anything as being precious or irreplaceable. And the logical extension of that would be nothing would be important or urgent. There would always be tomorrow. And so life would be de-energized completely if nothing could be important or urgent. And the more I think about that, the more excited I am about being in the middle of the perfect plan where we do have the capacity to be excited about how precious and important and urgent and therefore amazing and beautiful everything is or can be. And that sort of percolates up as an excitement and passion. So I don't think it'd be possible for me to have gratitude if I were not mortal. That's it.
That's beautifully put. Thank you. I remember running across a quote from Thomas Merton, a theologian, Thomas Merton, and he said, in considering any important decision in your life, and certainly in considering your priorities in life, he said it's imperative to consult your death. And I guess for the same reason Samuel Johnson once said, when you know you're to be hanged in a fortnight, concentrates the mind wonderfully. And I will never forget when I was a reporter at the Cincinnati paper, I did a series of profiles on people who were forced to consult their deaths because they had a doctor tell them they were dying. And so these are the people who've been told they have 6 months to live. And I wanted to know what that experience was like and what those people could teach the rest of us about how to live better without getting a diagnosis like that. And fair to say everybody was shattered by the news initially, but most of them were also liberated by it and in some really dramatic ways. I remember one woman said, my cancer diagnosis was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I was in my mid-20s when I heard this. I couldn't fathom how, of all the things that could happen to a human in the course of life, death, a cancer could be the best. And she said, I'm no longer trapped by life. My passions and my loves are finally released, she said. I'm free to speak my mind, free to follow my heart, and I'll never forget this comment. She said, I'm free to rearrange my priorities so that they are no longer an insult to the brevity and the preciousness of life, which is quite a statement. I was so moved by that. And years and years later, I remember reading Stephen Covey's book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And, you know, the first habit is, if I remember, be proactive. Take responsibility for your life, make it happen, etc. The second habit is start with the end in mind. And I had these series of profiles in my mind while I was reading that chapter. Because what he's essentially saying is have a sense of where you're headed. And I don't think it's an exercise in morbidity. I think it's an exercise in life affirmation to keep the end in mind. And that's why I'm just such a firm believer in this piece and to find some way to gently remind yourself of this fact.
That's a beautiful way for us to conclude this conversation for tonight, because that is a real important central theme for the way you conclude the book, is that relationship between our mortality and the passions in our lives. So
right.
It's beautiful that we've come back to that. So Thank you, Ellis, and thank you, Greg.
Yeah.
I'm going to wrap things up now with a couple of announcements and then turn it over to Greg for any closing remarks that he would like to make. Maybe first I should ask you, Greg, if people would like to follow up with you in any way about your speaking or about consulting with you or in any other way reaching out to you, what's the best way for them to do that? I know that your website, which I've sent out to people, greglevoy.com, GREDGLEVOY, is one way. Is there a contact?
No, that's really World Headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
Is the website. I mean, all of my material is on there, my speaking schedule, my contact information, and all of that is pretty much there. So I would say that's probably the simplest answer.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
I'm sure you'll be hearing from some folks on the call.
Well, that'd be wonderful.
Great. You'll be hearing from me.
Okay.
So just a few announcements. If you're on this call and are not getting the Edgewalker newsletter, you can email me at Judy, J-U-D-I, at edgewalkers.org to receive the free newsletter in the future. We do have a Walking on the Leading Edge workshop coming up February 27th and 28th. That's almost full, and really today would be the last day to register because there's some pre-work. So actually tomorrow would be the last day. So if you're interested in that workshop, you can reach me at that same email. We also have an Edgewalker profile where people can take the Edgewalker questionnaire and learn more about where you are in terms of your strengths and Edgewalker qualities and Edgewalker skills. And the next time after the end of this month that we'll be doing any Edgewalker presentations is in April at the Spirituality and Creativity in Management World Congress in Barcelona. And that is April 23rd through 25th. And Ellis and I will be doing an Edgewalker workshop at that. So those are some of the upcoming events and things that you can participate in. So with that, Greg, I'd like to turn it over to you for any last comments. And thank you so much for being on this call. It's just wonderful to connect with you again and to hear your wisdom. Like, I think it's almost 10 years later since
right.
we first met. So
well, wonderful. Thank you.
Great
thank
to have you with us.
Yeah, I'm delighted to be here and to reconnect with you as well. So, summary statement, let's see. I guess my sense of what I want to share at the end is just, and really it's just, I guess, a message that infuses itself through the book, and that is simply that life is so remarkably rich, and we often settle for so little, and remember what Abraham Maslow said. He's the guy who coined the term self-actualization. He said that self-actualizing types are the people who make the growth choice over the fear choice a dozen times a day. And I just love that because it says that there are lots of little opportunities to come back to life, to realize who we are, to self-actualize, to fall back in love with life. There are thousands of ways. Who was it, Rumi or Kabir said, there is 100 ways to kneel and kiss the ground.
Mm, yeah.
And I just, I suppose that would be my parting piece, is just to remember how wonderfully rich it is and how much there is to experience while we're here.
Mm. Thank you so much. That's a beautiful way to conclude. And thank you, everybody, for being on the call.
Yeah, really. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the invite.
Thank you so much, Judy and Greg. It was wonderful.
Awesome.
Right. Thank you.
And Judy, be well, okay?
All right. I am doing great. Thank you so much.
Good. I've been thinking about you. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Judy.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye-bye.